From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in 1997 in Tacoma, Washington. A man in his early 20s, a shot all-timer, was driving home with friends from a movie, and another car was following them. In that car was a gang member who had mistaken the identity of the people in Irshad's car. That person pulled out an assault rifle and fired 24 shots. Irshad was struck three times and one of his friends was killed. We're telling this story because, first of all, I kind of want to apologize. And Irshad Altimer is someone you've heard on this program multiple times, talking about a range of subjects, including criminal justice and reforms. He's a professor in the Department of Criminal Justice and the deputy director of the Center for Public Safety Initiatives at RIT. But I never knew his own personal story of the gun violence that changed his life. I've asked him to come tell that story. You might have read it recently in Post magazine. I want to explain how it informs the work that he's doing today. So first of all, Dr. Altimer, I am sorry that I did not know, you know, your story.
It's okay, Greg. Most people don't know the story.
Well, and I bring it up because, in kind of digging back into it, your hometown paper, Tacoma's written about it. And, you know, so I missed it. And I at least would have told you off air how sorry I am and how much I admire you even more so than
Thank you, Evan. I really appreciate it.
So, 1997, you grew up in Tacoma, Washington?
Absolutely. Yes. Yeah. I grew up in Tacoma, Washington.
You'd gone to, was it Scary Movie?
Yeah, we went to go see Scary Movie. I had just returned home from college. I was in my sophomore year, and we had been home for about 10 days. And so, you know, we always tried our best to catch up with all of our friends on the summer break. And so we caught up, and we all met at the Dollar Theater. And after that, we went home. We went to a friend's house. Mm-hmm. And when we left, basically the incident happened after we left that house.
Were you driving?
Yes, I was driving.
You were driving. Yeah. How many people were in the car?
There were five people total in the car.
I have read, and you can tell me if this is right, that though you were struck three times, you only felt one of the gunshots. Is that right?
Yes. The incident, when those kind of traumatic incidents happen, it's really remarkable because it happens really fast, but it's almost like it's in slow motion. And so once I realized that they were shooting at us, I just put my head down and pushed the pedal on the car, and they followed my car and chased us for about a block and a half. And while they were following us, they were shooting multiple rounds into the car.
And you're still driving.
And I'm still driving. I felt one of the shots, and I lost control of my car, and I crashed in a nearby field. And it wasn't only until after I crashed that I realized I had been shot in the wrist, because the young woman next to me, she was hysterical at the fact that I had been shot and there was blood coming out of my wrist.
But you didn't feel that
I
one.
Still didn't feel it. And then I got out of my car and I ran for about a block. And there was a local corner store. And the men at the store were very, very scared, obviously, seeing the shooting. They had locked the doors. And then some woman just showed up. I had never met. She was maybe a blonde-haired woman in her 40s. And she demanded that those men open the door. And she really comforted me during that very difficult time.
When you ran from that scene, did you run alone? I mean, did you?
Yeah, so I just, you know, it's like a, you know, flight. I just.
Following your instinct?
Following my instinct, and I just fled to the closest place that I thought people might be. All of my friends, besides my friend Corey, who was killed, also fled. They ran in different directions, and it wasn't until a few minutes after I got into the store that we all caught up with one another and realized what had really happened.
I know it's not. I know you've thought about it probably every day. Every day, do you think about that?
Often, very often.
Okay.
Yeah.
And I don't mean to, you know, ask questions that are tough, but did you know at that moment that your friend had died?
Absolutely. It's really a strange thing because I only saw his body like in a silhouette. I didn't really see all of the details, but I looked back in my car and I knew immediately that he was gone. And then when I got to the corner store, I informed my friends, and they didn't even know yet, and they went back to the car, and then the police showed up and they confirmed everything.
He was in the back seat.
Yes.
Are you even able to process anything in that moment, or are you just simply thinking, I've got to survive somehow?
I just think it's survival, pure survival mode.
Yeah.
You just kind of, you know, I think a lot of times you can second guess things. You know, you see movies about, you know, what the action heroes do when they're in those kind of situations. But in real life, you're kind of just in survival mode. You're just reacting. And then afterwards, it wasn't really until I was airlifted to the hospital. And once I got to the trauma center in Seattle that I really realized the gravity of the situation.
You were struck three times, and as you said, you only felt one. That was in the backside?
Yes.
And any concern about paralysis, or did it mostly, you know, just strike tissue? Did you worry about, you know, sort of being able to move? Were you able to?
I had full functioning. When I got to the emergency room, the trauma center, the doctors were very concerned about my wrist. I was very blessed. I had a bullet fragment hit my wrist, and I experienced no damage from that. And from the time I was shot, I have had full control over my hands. I had to have surgery to remove that fragment. In my left leg, the bullet went straight through, and I have two quarter-size exit wounds that are, you know, still, you know, permanent scars. But I had some weakness in my leg initially, but it didn't do any permanent damage. I was very fortunate in that way.
It could have hit a femoral artery. And I suspect you've thought about that many times, especially thinking about your friend Corey, right?
Absolutely.
Thinking about your friend Corey. Everybody else in the car, anybody else hurt?
One of the young women, she was skimmed in the back by a bullet, so she was taken to the hospital and discharged the same night.
You were in college at the time. What were you studying?
I was studying sociology, and Corey was studying criminal justice.
And
he had an interest in being a lawyer, and I wanted to be some type of social scientist. In fact, he used to make fun of me because he always talked about how nerdy the professors were and that I would turn out to be one of those nerdy professors. Of course, my view of professors is a bit different now, but...
professors are cool now.
Yeah, right? Professors are absolutely cool now.
Wow. I mean, that's beautifully sad now. And did you shift... Right away? Did you shift pretty quickly? What moved you toward criminal justice and the field that you ended up in?
While I was studying sociology, I was looking at really interested in social explanations of violence and social explanations of crime control. So sociology really, even though I was a sociology major, I was focusing on really criminology from the sociological perspective. And the reason I was interested in that as a college student is because the crack epidemic is really... had a major impact on my experience as a teenager growing up in a poor neighborhood and just seeing the impact on the violence and the drugs and how enticing it was for so many young men who were poor to stand in a corner and make $1,500 in a night and how difficult it was to turn that type of opportunity down.
Absolutely. And I think I'd like to explore that a little bit more as we go throughout the hour here, just to sort of cap a little bit of your own experience. You know, you teach... And you're in a country now where most of us have never seen an actual real life scene like you lived through. We see it depicted, as you say, in movies. You know, we watch The Wire. We try to figure out, you know, we try to feel like we understand, but you don't understand until you've been there. What's the biggest misconception people have about gun violence when it's actually happening?
I just think the biggest misconception is just how chaotic and overwhelming the scene is when you're there. I mean, it's you just can't describe the horror and you know, it's just, I mean, when I was in the car, it was really remarkable because I could hear the bullets leaving the chamber of the rifle, and then I can almost simultaneously hear them hitting my car. And trying to process that and figure all that out, it's just really overwhelming.
Because it's happening to you.
Yeah.
When did you figure out who had done that? I mean, in your own mind?
So what happened in our case was it turned out that I knew the driver of the car. We used to play basketball together a lot in middle school. We were actually close in middle school. And the shooter knew Corey, my friend, because we were kids who were known in the neighborhood, you know, but we weren't gangbangers. And what ended up happening is that once everyone really realized what had happened, one of the individuals, one of the passengers in the back seat, they also had five guys in their car, and they had been driving around the neighborhood for the last few weeks shooting at people. And one of the guys in the back seat, once he realized what happened, he went and he kind of tipped the police off and said, "Hey, I was in the car. I'm sorry, this is not what we intended to do. I knew Corey personally." And that kind of led to the investigation and then the conviction of the individuals involved.
There's just so much. It's just such a sad story. You mentioned that you did not get into gangs growing up.
Yes.
But did you feel the pull, or did you see people around you in that situation?
Oh, absolutely. I was getting recruited to be a gang member in sixth grade.
Okay, let me ask you a totally ignorant question, but that's part of what we're trying to learn here. Is when you say you were recruited, what is that like? What's actually happening?
I mean, you know, it's just your friends. When you grow up in these neighborhoods, there are groups of kids who played, you know, basketball together at the boys club and at the YMCA. And then in my personal experience, some of the kids were just, you know, getting fights, and some kids were tougher than others, but there were no gangs. But the gangs were coming at the same time that the crack epidemic was emerging. And so a lot of the kids who were just neighborhood kids, they started to solidify their group, and they also started making money. So I had kids I grew up with and played basketball and soccer with in the playground at high school and at elementary school. At sixth and seventh grade, dropping out of school, selling dope, and buying cars at 13 and 14 years old.
Wow.
And I think that, you know, this is not to make excuses for people, but people, I think the broader society really underestimated how enticing that was. I mean, random white people, if you lived in this inner city black neighborhood when I was a kid, you know, random white people would stop us and ask us if we had crack, right? So you knew the people who didn't live here. They just see the first black kid, hey, you got some crack? I had that happen to me. Hey, where can I find some crack? And people would fall. So it didn't take much time to say, hey, if I get a few of these little rocks, I can actually make some money. And a lot of kids, unfortunately, got sucked into that, and the subsequent violence and the arrest and all the other things that we know happened as a result of that.
What did you say when people would ask you?
I mean, mostly it was just like some of the people who were trying to get me to join were my friends. So I was like, man, I'm not interested. I'm playing basketball. Hey, I'm trying to chase these girls. I, you know, always had an excuse. And then I also was fortunate to have another group of friends who were similar minded. We were like minded in that we, even though we grew up in the neighborhood, we knew the kids who were gangbanging. We could hang with each other. And so once I had that, my own friendship group that was separate, I was able to somewhat isolate myself from that.
Would it have been easier for you to join a gang, or was it easier for you to not?
Oh, that's a great question. You know, and, I think it. I was fortunate because my mother had moved like somewhat on the outskirts of the neighborhood. And so the pressures weren't as strong as for me as for some of the other kids, but still, I think in some ways it would have been easier for me to join a gang, just because, you know, there was a lot of pressure if you're not in the gang, because you go to places and people don't know you and you have to deal with different people. And I think there's a lot of, it's interesting being a young black male growing up at that time, because, you know, you're being targeted by the gang members, but you're all the broader society also views you suspiciously just because you're from that neighborhood or from that area, right? So you're kind of caught in between kind of this kind of very tough circumstance.
As you say, when random white people saw you, they assumed that you'd be
Was in that neighborhood, and I'm walking down the street, I gotta have some crack on me, right?
What did you say to them when they would
ask? I say, man, just go down the street, somebody will flag you down or something, you know?
That's amazing. We're talking to Dr. Irshad Altimer, who's a professor in the Department of Criminal Justice and Deputy Director of the Center for Public Safety Initiatives at RIT, and talking about how his personal experience growing up has informed his work today here. When it comes to the experience of being in a gang, that's something that is very abstract for people, and it's probably something that we don't fully understand. What would it have meant for you in seventh, eighth, ninth grade? What does that mean for you on a daily basis? Is there an expectation that if you're in the gang, are you absolutely selling drugs? Are you asked to do anything else? You know, what does it really entail?
I think a lot of the individuals who are, well, first of all, in these gangs, people have different roles. So, you know, there are certain people who are more violent than others. There are certain people who are selling drugs. You know, right now we have an issue currently with gangs in America where you have some guys on the gang where they might not do much, but they make diss tapes on Facebook to diss other people, you know, so different people may have different roles. I think the biggest thing that attracted those young men, though, was just the sense of camaraderie and status and protection that they felt that they had from joining the gang.
Is it all male? I mean, is it mostly male still?
Mostly male, yeah. Yeah.
Is that the case? I mean, how much have you examined what Rochester has?
So Rochester is interesting in that it's mostly like loosely defined crews. and these crews are amorphous. So we do have some gangs in Rochester, but if you look at a lot of the violence in Rochester, some's with defined gangs, some is with these loosely defined groups that they may take a name, but the name may change within 6 months, or the membership may change within 6 months. So it's very difficult. Rochester is unique in that a lot of the violence is really disputes between loosely organized crews as opposed to highly organized gangs.
Is it wrong to call it gangs?
Oh, no. I think there's some benefit to naming the groups if they identify themselves in some way. But I also think it's very dangerous for us to overstate the role of gangs and gang violence. Some of the violence that we see in Rochester is between, like, for instance, you may see retaliatory violence between members in gangs. But before we say that's definitively caused by the gang, we have to really understand the nature of that particular dispute. Sometimes, if we look at this closely, we find that this is really two people affiliated with gangs who are really beefing over a girl. Sometimes it actually is gang violence. So I think it's necessary when you have those groups to call them gangs, but it's also necessary to understand the nature of the violence that they're in and not overstate the role that gangs may play in today's violence in places like Rochester.
Let me give you a few ideas, and you tell me if we're on the right track or not when it comes to understanding gangs. From your experience in Tacoma growing up and from what your study, your research, your work in Rochester. So, for example, the majority of people who join gangs are growing up in a situation that feels a little hopeless. They don't see a lot of career path, job success, and they don't feel like there's a lot of alternatives, yes or no?
Well, I think that's true. But I also think that that's true for a lot of the larger people in those communities who don't join gangs.
Okay.
So I'm not here to say that poverty and hopelessness doesn't matter, because I think it does matter for a lot of those young people. But we don't always understand the exact mechanisms through which people make the decision to join the gang. And they're not the same for all the same people.
Okay. Are young men growing up without active fathers, are they more likely to join gangs?
I can't say that definitively.
Okay.
Because if we look at the, I do think that growing up without a father is increasing the likelihood of exposure to crime early on. It is influencing dropout rates. It is influencing other issues related to crime. But in terms of Rochester, I can't definitively say that influences onset of gang involvement.
I just think about, especially single mothers, single fathers too, and there are some, but most of the single parents, especially in our community, are single moms.
Well, yeah, so we do know, if we look at the broader research nationwide, that unsupervised youth groups are an important precursor to gang formation. And we find that it is a lot more difficult for single parents to supervise youth and have strong social control over those youth. So I don't want to say that single parents doesn't matter, but it's difficult to make these broad generalizations for specific cities.
Okay, sure. When you say unsupervised youth group, just groups of friends?
So groups of friends without activities, young kids standing on the corner all day. What we find before these gangs emerge is that usually there are these loosely defined groups in uncontrolled settings. So, I mean, unstructured activities like the streets, house parties, street corners. These are the areas where we often find these things, the formation of these gangs to be more likely.
What's the kind of intervention that might help in that situation?
It's really, I think there are a lot of angles we can take. One of the things we're doing at RIT is we're focusing on what we call near-term violence reduction. And this is looking at people who are actively engaged in violent disputes and trying to reduce that. Let me give you an example. Right now, we know around 150 to 200 people every year get shot in Rochester. And around 95% of those people are minorities. Young Black and Latino males. A disproportionate number of these young Black and Latino males are engaged in some criminal activity, and they're settling their grievances outside the legal structure that we have set up, and so violence emerges. What do we do when someone shows up at the hospital with a gunshot wound? Well, the U of R, they give them some support. Pathways to Peace might show up for a few minutes afterwards. But after that person goes home, an RPD investigator may come and ask some questions. If he doesn't cooperate, then that may, the case may be closed. After that, what do we do? Do we have a coordinated effort to say this person is directly involved in gun violence? They've been shot. Can we provide them services? Is this a result of an ongoing beef? What can we do to minimize the likelihood of violence, subsequent violence? Oftentimes, the reason we don't do that is because of the nature of the people who show up and because we have not coordinated all of our different services in a way that targets that small group of people who are engaged in violence.
What's the impact when you don't have a coordinated response?
The impact when you don't have the coordinated response is, I think, what we see in a lot of cities, Rochester, Chicago, Cleveland, where we see subsequent retaliation and what people are now calling the contagion of violence, where people are handling their disputes and their violence through revenge and retaliation. And this basically leads to further violence in the community and exacerbates existing violence. The thing I like to emphasize is that in a place like Rochester, we may only have, in a given year, 250 active shooters, right? Are people who are actively involved criminally, mm-hmm. what I mean by active shooter, not you know, like a...
Still active.
Yeah,
of course.
So when you put that in context, you say, well, this is a problem. First of all, it lets you know that even though the majority of people who are getting shot are young minority males, it also tells you that the overwhelming majority of minority males have, even in the poorest neighborhoods, are not engaged in gun violence.
Otherwise, those numbers will be much
otherwise,
higher.
Those numbers will be 10, 15,000 people
of
a year.
Of course, yeah.
Right? And so what this tells us is that if we actually targeted the people who may be least desirable in the eyes of some people in society and most disconnected with our traditional institutions, but if we targeted them, we could actually have some type of potentially immediate violence reduction that could, in the long term, increase public safety and quality of life in a lot of our most troubled communities.
Okay, so there's, I think, some profoundly important things that I'm hearing from Dr. Altimer here. First of all, that number of people who have been what we'd call active shooters, much smaller group than even some of the stereotyping about cities like Rochester.
Absolutely.
Much smaller group. So that's a problem that if you coordinate the response, you can maybe get your head around some of this.
You think about it. The other thing, and I don't... You know, if you think about the total universe of shootings in Rochester, mm-hmm. so we have 200 shootings and we have some shots fired and we have some houses getting shot into, maybe that's 1,500 total incidents in a year. I think that might be a little high, but let's just say for the sake of discussion, that's 1,500 incidents of some type of gun being shot or shooting at someone. And let's say for the sake of discussion that each offender, on average... Because it's not, each of these incidences are not being committed by a single person, oftentimes because of retaliatory violence. So let's say each offender does 5 of those, right?
Yeah.
Then you say, so we have 300 active offenders in a given year in the city. But for everyone you eliminate or you provide services to or you prevent from subsequent violence, you can actually have a larger impact than just one or two fewer shots in the future because it's a small proportion of active offenders.
Might be 4, 5, 6.
Absolutely.
More,
you may
yeah.
be able to have intervention with 15 people that can lead to a 20% reduction in gun violence in the city if it's targeted correctly.
Okay, see, and this has given us some hope here. And the other reason I want to sort of make sure we stay on Dr. Altimer's point is that I promised him we're not going to get political. We're not.
But I'm a professor, so I don't mind getting too political, but go ahead.
Okay. It wasn't that long ago. It was right before the election that we had two candidates for New York State Assembly on this
yes.
program. And the Republican in that race, who did win,
yes.
and won handily, Joe Arrigo, talked about his old neighborhood on Carter Street that he
yes,
grew up in.
Yes, I read the articles about that.
And said that he wouldn't even go down there in an armored car. And I said, well, I'll take you down there. Yeah. And he said, it better have bulletproof windows.
Absolutely.
His vision of Rochester is bullets indiscriminately flying all the time.
Absolutely.
And what you're describing is something entirely different.
Yes, and I don't want to minimize the serious nature of the gun violence
of course
that happens in some of our communities.
Or pretend there is no gun violence.
Or pretend there is no gun violence. But any of these so-called hotspots, we could leave right now and walk down Jefferson, Conkin, Clifford, Hudson, and for the most part, be left alone. The violence is not happening all the time. It is at levels that we need to reduce. And also the violence is happening between known individuals who are, like I said, usually settling some type of grievance in using violence. But it's usually not. Most cases of violence are not like my scenario, where it's a mistaken identity, a college kid just got hit. That happens, but those are the rare incidents that happen in the urban settings.
Between crews, between gangs often.
Absolutely.
Okay, so before we get our only break of the hour, I'll let our listeners know, if you want to call the program, I should have told you earlier, you can do that. It's 844-295-TALK, toll free. I just got so wrapped up in the conversation with Dr. Altimer. 844-295-8255. Or if you're in Rochester, 263-WXXI. That's 263-9994. You can find me on Twitter at Evan Dawson. You can email me, edawson@wxxi.org. I think of what you're describing as someone who's involved in gun violence, either a victim or, you know, someone who has maybe fired shots in a criminal matter. Hopefully, we're not talking homicides in this case, but as you said, sort of in a dispute, maybe firing into a house, those kind of things. So whatever end we're on, we're talking about interventions that may work. This doesn't feel all that different to me than conversations about helping people who've dealt with, I think of Haiti, I think of natural disasters. There's this initial response, and it's strong, and it's swift, and it's focused, and then 3 days later, a week later, it's like the world moves on to other things.
Absolutely.
And the result is sort of inevitably that the problem doesn't always get solved. So give me a sense, you've kind of laid it out, but what is the best roadmap for, let's say, a person who has been a victim, a gunshot wound victim, survives it, you don't want them retaliating, you don't want them ruining their own life by going after somebody else in this way, but you've got to intervene in an effective way immediately, but also sustainably. What's that roadmap look like?
I think you need to have a formal law enforcement approach, and you need to have leverage all of your non-law enforcement assets. So from the law enforcement's perspective, obviously, the quicker there can be some closure to this incident, you reduce the likelihood of subsequent violence. Unfortunately, a lot of the victims are uncooperative. That makes things difficult for the police. We're hoping to help deal with the case closure issue. We're working with the city of Utica right now and the city of Newburgh to try to increase that so that we can, I think, bringing justice to communities will help reduce the likelihood of retaliation. That's one end. On the other end, though, we need to think about all of the people in the community who are agents of change, whether it's our Center for Dispute Settlement, our Pathways to Peace, our pastors in the faith, our leaders in the faith community. How can we better coordinate those entities to have some type of wraparound service? So for instance, one thing we have a lot of people doing a lot of good right now, but it's for the general public. No one's saying we're going to target gun violence victims with a social worker, and this social worker will coordinate all the wraparound services. In addition to that, we will have a protocol that we make sure for the first 6 months after that shooting, we will make sure we reach out to that person. The reason I'm saying that is because if you look right now at some of the informal or the non-law enforcement approaches to reducing violence, such as Cure Violence, in neighborhoods that had that, and this is a dispute resolution by non-police officers, some of those neighborhoods have had substantial reductions in violence just using Cure Violence workers without using the other resources they have. So if we use those other resources in a more coordinated manner, there's a great potential here. But right now, there's a struggle with that kind of coordination.
But as you said, it's got to be months.
It has to be. It cannot be this. He shows up to the hospital. We come. We give him some good words, and he goes back to his community. It cannot be. He has to show up at our comfort zone. This is what we like to do also. We like to put up programs that keep us in our comfort zone, right? Because the street corner is not a comfortable place for most of us. The question is, are we willing to leverage our services to go to those individuals? Yes, they're on the margins. Maybe they dropped out of high school. Maybe they have a criminal record. And can we leverage this, our services, to target them? Now, some of them won't take services, but for those who do, we remove them from that lifestyle. What I think people also realize is, take neighborhoods like the 19th Ward, where there's tremendous investment right now in that community, but that community still has problems with gun violence in certain parts of 19th Ward. If you can say, I'm going to target the 19th Ward, and have this wraparound service just for the 19th ward and have a 30 or 40% reduction in violence just in that neighborhood. What does that do for that community, for quality of life? What does it do for investment in the city? What does it do for the perception of the city? So I think oftentimes when we think about these strategies, we just think, why should I help this thug? You know, a lot of people call these programs hug a thug programs, right? And that mentality is really ridiculous because we lose sight of the larger implications for society when we fail to address this problem.
Dr. Altimer, my guest for the hour, he is the Rochester Institute of Technology, Deputy Director of the Center for Public Safety Initiatives, and been there for how long? How long you been at RIT?
5 years.
5 years.
It's been a really
good
great.
5 years?
Yeah, RIT is a cool place, man.
Well, I always learn from you, so let's get our only break of the hour. Pete and Gates and others' comments that have come in online, we'll get your questions and comments for Dr. Altimer after this break on Connections. Coming up in our second hour, Rochester Mayor Lovely Warren joins us in studio. We're talking about red light cameras. The city has decided to scrap the red light camera program when the contract runs out at the end of this month. So starting January 1st, no more red light cameras in Rochester, and the mayor has said there are reasons for that. We will discuss her concerns about what the findings showed and who was disproportionately impacted. That's next hour. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. To the phones we go, and Pete in Gates. Go ahead, Pete.
Hi, Evan. How's it going?
Good. Very good.
Interesting discussion, but one key component of stopping gun violence is to stop the gun runners coming from south. They buy handguns, and like a whole trunk load, and they come up here and they sell them to the gangs. So, you know, your guest has all these ideas, but he's not getting to the root of the problem. And then also, when the red light issue is stopped, many drive-by shootings are caught on the red light cameras. So the mayor wants to eliminate the red light cameras, which is going to cause more violence, because now the gangbangers can drive through them red lights knowing they're not going to be caught on film.
Pete, I thank you. And Mayor Warren is one of my guests next hour. She'll be right here in the seat that Rashad is sitting in.
Because so. Many cities have caught violence on red light cameras.
Okay. You know what I mean?
So she, sure. Whoever is deciding to eliminate the cameras, it doesn't have maybe a half a brain or so.
Okay. Pete, thank you for the phone call. I don't know personally if you do our shot about cameras, red light cameras capturing those kind of moments. I know there's a lot of cameras in the city.
Yeah, so just if I can comment on both of those statements.
Absolutely.
And thank you, Pete, for your comments. First, I would say that we're not disregarding the role of guns. Obviously, we have over 300 million guns in circulation, and we have a very weak structure compared to other Western developed nations for tracking illegal gun transfers. And tracking illegal gun transfers would definitely help address this problem. What I also want to say is that even in this existing environment, we can do better, and that's my point of emphasis. As for the cameras, there are numerous other cameras. You know, I think the mayor, when she comes in, she can talk about the exact number, but the city of Rochester, the police have cameras separate from those little blue light cameras or the police cameras, and there are other cameras that they have access to separate from the red light cameras. Keep in mind also that the majority of our gun violence does not involve drive-by shootings. So drive-by shootings are about 6%, I believe.
Another misperception?
Of the shootings. Just like assault weapons are only used in about 4%. Most of our shootings in urban areas involve handguns in the street. So they're not drive-bys and they're not involving assault rifles.
Okay, before I jump back to the phones, Dawn in Rochester, wait there for one moment, but I want to read Melissa's email because Rashad just brought up so-called assault rifles, which is, Melissa wanted to know what kind of gun was used in the shooting in which you were shot, in which you lost your friend in 1997. We opened the hour with that conversation of the gun violence that changed or shot Alzheimer's life. When he was growing up in, well, you were in college at the time, but you were back home in Tacoma, Washington. Melissa wanted to know what kind of gun, and just wanted to know your thoughts on proposed bans out there. So I mentioned so-called assault rifle, was it?
So it was a Mac 90, which is the AK, the Chinese version of the AK-47. And I think there is some use to regulating assault weapons simply because the primary purpose of those weapons is to wreak tremendous havoc. But I also think and if you look at places like Australia, where they had complete bans, they did have fewer subsequent mass shootings with these kind of weapons. But the American context is also different, because if we got rid of every single assault rifle tomorrow, if I could just wave a magic wand and do that, we would still have tremendous levels of violence, because most of our gun violence is with handguns.
The vast
majority. Over 90%.
Yeah, and I think my goal in facilitating conversations about gun violence and proposals on guns, I know it's always emotional.
Yes.
I'm an evidence person. I try to understand the evidence best I can. I try to resist motivated reasoning and confirmation bias in these discussions. I think we have to be able to say that assault rifles, or so-called assault rifles, and I know there are some people who own those kinds of firearms who don't even like that term, and I understand that. But what is the actual purpose? You just mentioned, what's the purpose of the creation?
Well, these are military weapons. I mean, we shouldn't deny that. One of my students, who's a vet, he tells me, "Hey, I use my gun for sport." I'm like, I said, "What do you mean? How do you make that a sport?" And he said, "Well, you know, I go shoot out a couple thousand rounds on Saturdays. You know, me and some of my buddies." So some people do use these assault rifles for sport, but they are military grade weapons.
Yeah, and I think a society is allowed to decide that's a bad way. That's not a good sport.
Yeah, I mean, but we also have to recognize that, particularly in some of these rural areas, that is part of the culture.
Absolutely.
Right? And so how do we regulate these weapons while also recognizing that that is part of the culture? You know, you meet people who say, "Yeah, my dad gave me my first gun at 11, right? And I had my first gun and I went shooting." That's my experience with guns is different.
yeah, of course. But I think a lot of people who don't own guns hear that and they're horrified. But it turns out the vast majority of gun owners, as you say, in rural areas, are remarkably trained, respectful,
and
safe,
responsible. But the problem, larger problem with so much guns in the general circulation is the legal guns do a small proportion do make it to the illegal market.
Yes.
And they are transferred, they are stolen, and without any way. And think about it right now, if I want to buy a car, a used car, I can go to Carfax.com. It's not an ad for them, but Carfax.com and put in the VIN number and see every single place that car has been. Yet, if RPD picks up a gun right now that they think is involved in criminality and they want to know how it's been transferred, they got to go to the ATF and wait. There's no such system that we have. So on that and so having a system that better helps track illegal transfers would help us to protect law-abiding citizens' rights, but also limiting that small proportion of those legally owned guns that make it into the illegal market and really cause a lot of harm in our urban areas.
And I think to put a point on the question on so-called assault rifles, banning them may be logical in many people's minds. It will not stop the vast majority of gun violence that happens in this country, and it is not a panacea. And if it feels logical, okay, but it's a lot more complex.
And it's easy for a lot of politicians to go after to go after assault rifles, because for a lot of gun owners, they have shotguns and handguns. So, you know, assault rifle owners are kind of a specialized group, even amongst gun owners. Right. And so it's easy for politicians to go after that because you have these big, scary guns. We're going to eliminate those and everything will be all right. But it doesn't really, I'm not saying it there's no value, but it doesn't really get to the crux of the problem. And we should understand that.
Yeah, it's a small percentage of guns that are out there. And we have a volume issue with guns.
Absolutely.
300 plus million guns.
Absolutely.
And I don't know of any nation in the world that has that many guns per capita for its citizenry. So.
And there's an interaction between the gun violence, the culture, I mean, the gun availability, the culture, and the really harsh conditions we see in some of our urban areas that all contribute to the violence. So we have to, I think it's important to look at these issues and understand how they all collectively come together to contribute.
Poverty.
Absolutely. So if you look at, you know, some of our poorest neighborhoods, it is true that the majority of people in those neighborhoods will never pick up a gun and become a gang member. But it's also true that over 60 years of research has found that in areas where there's more poverty and disadvantage, there's more gun violence. And we shouldn't ignore those findings.
All right, Melissa, hope we answered that question. Let's get Dawn in Rochester next up. Go ahead, Dawn.
Hi, good afternoon. I was actually honored to be at an event where Rashid was awarded a Yahya Abdullah Award last week at the River's Edge.
I think
that was you.
Yeah, that was me.
And
thank you.
Yeah, I have the pleasure of growing up or living across the street from Yahya Abdullah and learning a lot from his message and how he dealt with the youth in our community. I moved to the city from the suburbs, so it was like a little culture shock. And you were right on point with the kids in the corners, how do we get to, we can't ignore them, and we try to address them calling the police, but that's just a cat chasing the mouse over and over again. So we've actually implemented a few strategies of being up where they are more often, whether we're cleaning the streets, just engaging with the businesses, trying to engage with the loitering youth that sell the drugs. But connecting the services, you have Pathways to Peace, and you have the Boys and Girls Club, and you have CDC, but how do the neighborhood groups maybe get more involved with those entities so we can together go to our street corners and work on a plan to get these kids into the right path, into college, into, you know, GED classes?
I think that's a great question. I think one of the things that my colleague and I, Dr. Clofus, we have been talking about is, can we create some type of office or even neighborhood level coordination committee that helps us? Because there are, one of the things that we have in this city is a lot of people who care and who are doing remarkable things, but we're not coordinating those things.
Right.
And so the question is, if we can, like for instance, if we had a social worker and we were able to coordinate with all the different care. And keep in mind, some of those youth on the corner may not take that service, but for those who would, I think if we coordinated that, we can collectively reduce violence. I'm glad that, you know, you have an interest, and I hope that this discussion will lead to some coordination between those groups. And at RIT, we're always willing to help in any way that we can.
I'd love to see social workers assigned to different neighborhood associations, because we have strong neighborhood groups in our city that really are caring, involved people. And that's just when we know our kids on the corner. We know who we need to help. And
absolutely.
Without the added help for us, we find it difficult to do.
And oftentimes we identify some of the kids who have problems even early on. I mean, if you talk to some of the student resource officers at RPD, and they can tell you at sixth grade some of the kids who are having trouble. Sit and talk to those student resource officers. They know the families. They've had some interactions. But, you know, it's only so much law enforcement can do. And we know we can't arrest our way out of the problems. But if we're identifying kids early and people in the neighborhoods know, then what can we better do with the wraparound services is something I think we really need to look at in Rochester.
I have an email from a listener named Mark who wanted to know what your thoughts on Stop and Frisk are. He says he heard a lot about it in the presidential campaign, and there was a talk about making it sort of more of a nationalized policy. So that's from Mark. Wants to know your thoughts.
So I'm so glad you asked me that. I grew up in a neighborhood that was known as the Hilltop, and once the crime got bad, you know, people thought you were some kind of monster if you said you even lived in that neighborhood. And there was a lot of pressure on our police department at the time to deal with these young black kids causing all those trouble. And so, you know, I would get pulled over. I mean, one time I was at a park, and you know, I had a lot of, I don't want to slam the police because I had a lot of positive interactions with the police, but I was at a park, and the police officer said, "You're loitering. You're loitering at the park." And I was a college student, and I told him, you know, officer, you know, I can't loiter. This is a park. Technically, you can't loiter at a park. And the officer just kind of walked away. And I think these kind of policies cause a lot of resentment amongst people who are not involved in crime, and that's majority in those communities. If you look at the New York police data, they collected guns in less than 1% of all the stop and frisks. And it also does something to our police department. It undermines legitimacy of our police department, and a lot of people simply come to resent the police department. And so it's unfair to a lot of our officers who have to kind of deal with the brunt of that resentment. The broader public is calling for a reduction, so they put the police officers to kind of make certain neighborhoods into medium security prisons because people are getting searched 2 and 3 times a month. And that leads to a lot of resentment, which in the long term, I think, undermines the credibility of law enforcement, the legitimacy of law enforcement, and the willingness of people to communicate. So I think a nationwide stop and frisk policy would be disastrous. The other thing I want to say just briefly is that a lot of people say, well, stop and frisk worked because we had a reduction in violence at that time. And it's really difficult for us to disentangle the effect of particular programs that start when violence is already decreasing. So it was implemented when we're having these already historical crime reductions. San Diego rolled out a community policing initiative that has similar reductions as New York, right? So I'm not saying that policing can't matter, but we don't want to overstate the role of stop and frisk, and we have to be careful about what it would do to the community and views of police.
As I say, I'm an evidence person. I would let listeners know, read the New York Daily News editorial essentially saying we were wrong about stop and frisk. They worried that in New York City, when stop and frisk was removed as a tool, that it would lead to all kinds of problems and a reversal in crime trends. And what was interesting is, as Dr. Altimer said, during stop and frisk, we saw a slight reduction in crime. We saw an even greater reduction in crime after stop and frisk. Yes. And the New York Daily News had to sort of eat a little crow and say, we were wrong. A lot of people in law enforcement there.
And I think this is one other thing we should think about here. What does it say about the broader society if in an attempt to deal with real problems in our urban areas, we decide the only solution is to turn our neighborhoods into medium security prisons? Because this is what you're doing. You have situations where the New York Times did an analysis. Some of the young men were being searched there 5 times a month. So once a week, you're making police officers search people. And the other thing that we have to think about is, what does that say about us as a society if that's the only way we can think about improving these communities? I think that's pretty damning for the society at large. We often focus on the police, but the police are just carrying out the larger wishes of the society. The other thing I would say is, again, if you want to learn more about this, look at the New York Police Department data that shows that it very rarely led to arrests. And that's part of the bigger problem there. And I don't think Mr. Trump, with all due respect, really looked at that data.
Before we let you go, on that subject of the way we can judge our fellow citizens, the president of Nazareth College is very upset about what happened with a couple of students who were attending church in Springfield.
Yes. And,
in fact, 3 Nazareth students attended Browncroft. Let's see here. What's the church? It's Browncroft Community Church in Penfield on Sunday. As part of their Sociology of Religion course, which requires students to attend religious services that are not of their own faith, 2 of the 3 students are Muslim. The one student who is not Muslim, no one sort of called out this student, but there were apparently some people at the church who were concerned about the Muslim students and wanted to call the Department of Homeland Security. And is this an example of what you see as the ways that we can, when we try to, whether it's building police community relations and what stop and frisk might do, or whether it's building interfaith relationships, societal relationships?
I think it really reflects the climate that in our broader society and the implications that has for members of minority groups. And oftentimes, of course, security is very important. But when we, in our quest for security, we undermine very basic principles of humanity, it presents other challenges for our society. And so as we have a quest for security, whether it's, you know, anti-terrorism or lowering violence in our neighborhoods, I think we want to stick to our values that make our society great. And if we move away from that, we will deal with the implications of that for generations. And I think a lot of people have a hard time really coming to terms with that reality.
I would also say, I think it's quite beautiful that Nazareth asks students to attend services from different faiths.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I mean, I think that's how you break down sort of those walls and bubbles.
Yes.
30 seconds, final thoughts that you want to leave the audience with as we think about, you know, going forward and trying to build safer communities and really using evidence and humanity?
Well, I think that, you know, Rochester is a place where we can make a difference, but we have to combine kind of our zeal to make a difference in people's lives with evidence-based practices. And I think we have to evaluate those practices and be willing to change accordingly. And we have to be willing to target those people who are on the margins and who we may even be scared of for those interventions in hopes of bringing about change in the neighborhoods.
Every time I see you, I think, I don't see you enough. I always enjoy the conversation and learn from you, Dr. Altman.
Thank you, Evan. And just, I appreciate your show.
Remarkable story. Thank you for being here.
Absolutely.
Greatly appreciate it. That's Dr. Arshad Altimer from the Department of Criminal Justice at RIT and Deputy Director of the Center for Public Safety Initiatives. I mentioned that Rochester Mayor Lovely Warren is going to be here coming up in just a few minutes. She's part of our next hour discussion on red light cameras.